On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is when we slow down developments, take them one at a time. A couple items up for discussion. A legal complaint argues that the state elections agency should remove more than 200,000 voters from the state's voter rolls. We'll look at that complaint from Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And the state Supreme Court is taking up a case brought by Will challenging the governor's veto powers. Should there be a limit to the governor's veto pen? And then on the voter rolls, have you recently moved but not updated your voter registration? Have you responded to a mailing on your current address? We're at 800-642-1234. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast, and she joins us most Mondays. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at these two legal challenges coming from Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The veto power situation, what is the challenge there? What does this lawsuit do?
So this lawsuit is challenging several of the governor's budget vetoes from the state budget bill. Essentially, what they're arguing is that his vetoes went too far, that they didn't just alter the language passed by the legislature. They actually created new laws. So they're calling it, they gave it kind of a snazzy name in the lawsuit. They're calling it the magician's veto. We sometimes, you know, kind of waved a magic veto pen and transformed the language into a new law. We kind of have these ways of describing gubernatorial vetoes in Wisconsin. We've had the Vanna White veto in the past, where you take out letters from words. The Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is kind of, I think they're kind of trying to add to that canon, if you will, and just say that this is a power that the governor has. And they acknowledge it's a power that the governor has had for obviously a while, and an act that previous governors have done. In this lawsuit and in their conversations about it, they have said that Governor Evers isn't unique in issuing this kind of veto. But they said they haven't really had the resources as an organization to challenge this until now. And so they say, you know, this has been part of the history of Wisconsin, but we think the line needs to be drawn right now.
What happens if this lawsuit is successful? What would the situation be?
So this would obviously make it impossible if the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, agrees with Will's argument for future governors to change bills to the extent that, you know, the argument can be made that they're transforming the language into something that wasn't legislative intent. But it would also knock down several of the governor's budget vetoes that are specifically mentioned in this lawsuit. So I think a big one that we've talked about somewhat frequently is this $75 million grant program for local road projects. The governor's veto didn't change the amount of funding for this transportation initiative. Essentially, what it did was it changed how the money was dispersed. It changed it from something that was already allocated and identified to different groups to this grant program that was administered by the Department of Transportation, kind of creating a pot of money and giving the department more discretion. That's something that really concerned Republicans because of just distribution of funds throughout the state. So there are some specific things like that that would be struck down. But I think the more kind of broad-ranging impact of this is just the future powers of the veto pen of the governor in Wisconsin.
He also had vetoed four abortion-related bills.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So this wouldn't necessarily have to do with that because this is a partial veto issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when the governor entirely vetoes a bill, which is what he did with the abortion bills, you would see the only way that the legislature could interact with that would be with would be to override that veto with a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a more legal avenue for individuals, the legislature, outside parties to argue that a governor's partial veto, where he just changes it rather than knocking the whole thing down, was inappropriate.
We're doing a roundup on politics with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White. You can join in. Should there be a limit to Governor Evers' veto powers? What are your thoughts here? Are you a city clerk? What are the biggest challenges you face with running elections. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Somewhat of a parallel here, let's look at the constitutional amendment that is up for debate. Republicans recently held a hearing to prohibit Governor Evers from using his veto pen to increase spending. And this has been in the works since July. What is being discussed around this amendment?
So this is another response to some of the governor's partial budget vetoes. Republican lawmakers were concerned about one of the governor's vetoes that increased school spending by about $65 million. He kind of nipped and tucked from a variety of other programs in the budget to create that funding. Lawmakers were concerned that he made that kind of financial change that they didn't agree with. So they introduced this proposed constitutional amendment, which is a way that you can limit the governor's veto powers, to make it so it would be impossible for the governor to make any change that increases state spending. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the Vanna White veto, the Frankenstein veto. That is how this process that they're proposing for this provision, that's how those things went into place. You propose them in the legislature, they have to pass two consecutive legislative sessions, and then they have to go to a statewide voter referendum. So if this successfully passes the legislature this session, we'll be seeing it back again next session, and then again before voters.
But Wisconsin gives its governor some of the most sweeping executive powers in the country by way of you can strike out words, you can merge sentences here. I mean, is this type of amendment just a long time coming here that, you know?
Well, I think, there definitely has been a movement in recent years to kind of put some checks on the governor's veto power. So we have seen these couple constitutional amendments over the past 30 years or so. I think, the conversation is just about how much power is the legislature and then, of course, the people of Wisconsin comfortable with the governor having. The governor does have some of the strongest veto powers in the country. You know, he can strike words, he can change punctuation. So there are a lot of things that the governor can do and could still do, honestly, even if this constitutional amendment were to go into place as well.
Well, to go into place, there are still quite a bit of barriers to that. How close are Republicans from putting this amendment into action?
Well, there are a lot of steps. You know, it would have to, this is very early in the process. This was just a public hearing. So it would have to pass the Senate and the Assembly this session, do the same thing next session, and then go to that statewide voter referendum and pass as well. And we've seen a statewide voter referendum fail recently, the referendum that would have eliminated the state treasurer's office. So we know that, that's obviously not a guarantee. It passes the legislature twice and makes it to that step. It's not a home run at that point.
Well, let's look at sexual assault here for a moment. State lawmakers met recently to consider this proposal to adopt a new Bill of Rights for sexual assault victims. What would this bill mean for Wisconsin?
So this is part of a nationwide push by an advocacy organization and some individuals involved with sexual assault policy across the country. Essentially, it would give sexual assault victims rights above and beyond those that are already afforded to crime victims in Wisconsin. So, for example, they would be guaranteed the right to choose whether or not to cooperate with law enforcement. They would be able to have the right to bathe immediately after their forensic examination. They'd have the right to have their evidence stored from that examination for 50 years, whether or not they choose to have that tested.
We are in the mix of the State Capitol Report with WPR's Laurel White as our guide, and you can join in. What should lawmakers do to address election security? Is an election security council enough to guard against hackers? Have you recently moved but not updated your voter registration? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. There's more State Cap in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking developments one at a time. A new council met last week to look at cybersecurity ahead of the 2020 election. Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says the decentralized election system is a mixed bag.
Having 1,922 local election officials involved in the process can be a little daunting. I think it also has an opportunity for us to have 1,922 points of strength in our system.
So what should lawmakers do to address election security? Is an election security council enough? Do you think Wisconsin should be more timely with purging voters if you've moved from your address? Join in 800-642-1234. And Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. She stays with us. Laura, we saw the new Wisconsin Election Security Council come together last week, 18 different organizations, including the FBI. They all meet together. What do we know what went down? What was discussed?
So this was the first meeting of this new council that was formed. So it was a lot of kind of laying the groundwork, figuring out what these different organizations do, what kind of roles they play in ensuring election security. I thought some of the really interesting things they talked about in terms of initiatives that are already in place are things that they're doing to help small towns in Wisconsin, more rural communities, clerks that don't have a lot of resources, to kind of learn about election security, get up to date, get the systems that they need to be secure ahead of the next election. Some of those things include online training on how to deal with cyber attacks, things like phishing emails. They're also rolling out a grant program for local elections officials that need to update their software ahead of the 2020 presidential election.
Oh, just like, you know, basic software upgrades to Windows 10.
Yeah, exactly. This is something that I wasn't aware of until I started talking a little bit more about election security. But, you know, the switch from Windows 7 to Windows 10, Windows 7 is no longer going to be supported by Microsoft in January. And that can lead to some, you might not think about it, it's not necessarily an elections issue, but security patches and things that will no longer be provided are crucial for the security of those local clerks' computers. So getting that funding to them and educating them about that switch, things like that are kind of a big focus of this security council right now.
Why do you see election security a major focus for Wisconsin officials right now?
So this has been a really big conversation since 2017. You know, we found out in 2017 that the previous year, Wisconsin election systems or state computer systems, rather, were targeted ahead of the 2016 presidential election by Russian hackers. We know that they kind of the language that they use within the security community for the state is they were knocking at the door. They mm-hmm. didn't get in. They did not successfully hack any state systems, but they attempted to do so. So this is something that people in Wisconsin take incredibly seriously in terms of making sure that the strength is there to continue keeping those folks out.
Well, let's take a look at the Elections Commission. You spoke with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, who filed a complaint against the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Here is Deputy Counsel Lucas Weber.
Our primary concern and the main reason with filing this complaint is to get the Wisconsin Elections Commission to do what the law says.
Okay, so what is being argued in this complaint?
So this is a legal complaint against the Wisconsin Elections Commission, one of the members, obviously, of that security council, that they're not following a state law that has to do with maintaining voter rolls in Wisconsin. So basically what this process is that they send letters to individuals that have been flagged for the Elections Commission as potential movers, somebody that's changed addresses. They get that information from a national system called ERIC. Wisconsin is a member of this system. ERIC flags people who have submitted change of address forms to the U.S. Postal Service, a different address on their vehicle registration. So the Elections Commission sends a postcard to that individual at the address where they have them registered to vote. And they say, hi, we have reason to believe that you may have moved. Do you still live here? If you still live here, let us know. We won't change anything. But if that person doesn't respond to that postcard within a certain amount of time, the Elections Commission removes them from the voter rolls at that address. It's just kind of a process of cleaning up voter rolls, making sure they're not bloated with people with the incorrect addresses. Where this legal complaint comes into place is the amount of time that the Elections Commission is waiting to remove those individuals. So the Elections Commission is currently under a policy waiting up to 2 years for someone to respond respond to that postcard before they take them off of the voter rolls. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty in this legal complaint is saying, hey, there's a state law that says you need to remove these people if they don't respond within 30 days. So we think this is a big problem, and we think you need to be changing your policy.
Well, let's take a call on this now. Mike joining us from Ladysmith. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, this is an issue that when I first heard it being brought up a couple weeks ago, just totally got my goat, because we just went through a whole big push to get forced into using voter IDs. Now, I don't have a problem with using voter IDs. That's not my gripe here. But one of the reasons for doing a voter ID is that you either use a driver's license or a DMV-issued ID, both of which have the address of the holder on them, and under what materials you need to register at the poll, one of the allowable items to have, in fact, the preferred ones, are your voter ID, the same thing you use for voter ID. So to me, this has become a bookkeeping exercise. This should not be an issue that's being pushed as hard as it is, you know, as if it's some kind of voter fraud. We have Register at the Polls, which has been a Wisconsin institution for decades, and we have voter ID, which has our legal address on it.
So, Mike, as you're saying here, that the processes are already in place. Laurel?
I think that's a really important point, that we do have same-day registration in Wisconsin. So individuals that aren't registered to vote can go in and do that. I think another important nuance of this complaint is that we're talking about people moving, right? And in sort of having their previous address in voter registration and having a new address in voter registration, how those things might complicate the system, compromise the integrity of voter rolls. And it's important to know, I think, for people who might not be familiar with the ins and outs of voter registration in Wisconsin, when you register to vote at a new address in the state, your previous registration is obviously wiped out. Mm. So it's not as if someone who has moved and doesn't respond to this postcard in 2 years but registers to vote in their new address is going to have two voter registrations in place and can go in and vote two times with two different IDs, you know, if they hang on to their old address or anything. So I think noting that is important. As Mike also mentioned, an individual with their new address can go in and register on the same day, too.
Well, let's talk about some things that people might go to vote on here as we talk with WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White in a roundup. Let's look at the 7th Congressional District. Last week, we saw the first Democrats announce a campaign to fill the seat vacated by former Congressman Sean Duffy. Brings the total number of candidates to 5. Who are these candidates?
So these two candidates are Lawrence Dale and Tricia Zunker, I believe. I haven't said her last name. Mm-hmm. Tricia Zunker, she's a Wausau school board president. She would be, interestingly, the first Native American representative in Congress from Wisconsin if she's elected. Lawrence Dale is a businessman, a veteran. Interestingly, he held his announcement in the state capitol, noting that he currently lives in Michigan, but he's planning to move to Wisconsin and into the district soon. So these are two individuals that, you know, as you mentioned, are coming in on the Democratic side of the race. We've had a pretty high-profile Republican candidate in the race for a while. State Senator Tom Tiffany has kind of been making the rounds for a couple weeks, getting to know voters. So now we're getting a little bit more of a partisan balance in terms of who's in the race and who's out there talking to people.
Shifting over to the 5th Congressional District, where we saw the retirement of Jim Sensenbrenner, what do we know about the candidates running in this district?
So this is the kind of a stronghold of Republican Party politics in Wisconsin. We've had a whole lot of folks express interest in running for this race. As of right now, we have one Republican candidate, Republican State Senate Majority Leader, actually, Scott Fitzgerald. So we're keeping an eye on that candidacy, and a number of other people who are considering a bid for that race, including a colleague of Senator Fitzgerald, State Senator Chris Kapinga.
All right. So we'll keep an eye on that. And quickly, before we let you go here, Governor Evers signed an executive order last week to create a climate change task force. What do we know there?
So this is a large group of people that the governor has gathered. It's individuals from government and from industry, agriculture, higher education, that are all tasked with helping the state mitigate and respond to the effects of climate change. This is something that the governor has talked about a lot. He talked about climate change during the campaign, bringing a phrase he uses, bringing science back to the state of Wisconsin. So this is something that's very much in line with a conversation that the governor's been having for a while.
Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, and she co-hosts the Politics Podcast. By the way, the Politics Podcast will be in Waukesha Thursday doing a live episode at Ray's Grain Brewing Company at 7:30. Coming up on the State Capitol Report, it's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What questions do you have for the speaker? What do you want to know about lawmakers' work so far this session? What do you think lawmakers should be focused on? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Speaker Voss after this news update here on the Ideas Network.